Session number 6104, reel 1.
Colonel Truscott, tape 1. Colonel Truscott, when did you join the army?
I joined the army, the regular army, on the 8th, 1934, which was my 18th birthday. But prior to that, I'd been in the Territorial Army for 3 years. But my parents would not let me join the army until I was 18. And as I say, on the 8th, 1934, I joined the Royal Signals.
Why did you choose the Signals?
Because in the in the first place, one of my relatives was in the Royal Signals, and it was a new corps, born in 1922. I'd been a regimental signaller and a gunner signaller in the Territorial Army, and this is what I wanted.
Where were you trained?
I was trained in Catterick, Yorkshire.
How long did that last?
That lasted for a year with, more than a year really. We had 6 months basic training to be a soldier, and then about 9 months trade training, and then I was posted as a B3 operator to Bulford in Wiltshire.
What's a B3 operator?
A B3 operator. It was an OWL B3, O-W-L. OWL is Operator Wireless and Line. And you have the three grades, that's B3, B2, and the top grade, B1. Now, being a new technician, if you like, or operator, I was posted as an OWL 3 to Bulford, 3rd Divisional Signal Regiment.
How long did you spend at Bulford?
Bulford from 35 to late 37, 1937.
And that was when your posting abroad came through, was it?
That's right, to Hong Kong.
What did you feel about being posted to Hong Kong?
Well, actually, I put in for Hong Kong. Before the war, you're allowed to put in for 3 stations, and you never got what you wanted. And I'd put in for Hong Kong, expecting India. But before the war, if you were posted to, say, the Gold Coast, you went for 9 months, which was a marvellous quick tour. But if you were posted to India, you went there for 5 years or more. Hong Kong was a 3-year station, and I wanted to see the Far East, so I was lucky.
What troop ship did you travel on to Hong Kong?
The HMS Dunera. It was a new troop ship.
Can you remember much about the journey?
Yes, I can remember a lot about the journey, because we then had an empire as we knew it. And you stopped off at the troop ships stayed in port at every colony or every part of the map that was red. And so we stayed in Gibraltar, and we marched around Gibraltar, Malta, the Suez, Port Said, Aden. These were all red spots on the map. Bombay, India, Ceylon, Singapore, and then Hong Kong. But it was marvellous to see the Union Jack flying in all these places, and I was very proud.
What were conditions like below decks where you were?
You're all in hammocks.
Living, yes.
One large area with hammocks, yes.
You didn't find it too bad?
It was all right, yes, except probably at night. With about 300 souls in one area, the air got a bit foul.
And how did you keep yourself busy on the voyage?
You had routine duties to do. Scrubbing of the mess decks and table waiting and things like that. Otherwise, you were sunning yourself on the deck or sightseeing or various routine jobs. It kept you busy.
So how long did it take you to reach Hong Kong?
My memory serves me right, 6 weeks.
And what was your first impression of Hong Kong when you arrived?
My first impression was a wonderful place, really, very busy. But I think Hong Kong hit me when, having got to Hong Kong, we were then put into barracks, and we were located not in the buildings of the barracks, but in tents, because we were going to be a new troop for the Kowloon defence. We were put in tents. My first memories of Hong Kong was waking up the next morning and hear the clip-clop, clip-clop of the wooden shoes that the Chinese used. And I knew I was in a different country, but I shall always remember that noise.
Where were the barracks situated?
Barracks were Woodfield Barracks on the head of Kowloon. It's right on the wharf area. It's now a park, I believe.
How long did you have to spend in tents before you moved into proper buildings?
They moved us, we were there about 2 months, and then they moved us into a school in the Nathan Road, and it was a wooden type school, now unused, and it was called CBS, Central British School.
That was back on the island?
No, in Kowloon.
Oh, Nathan Road.
In Nathan Road is in Kowloon. And we were put there, and we stayed there then until about 1940, I think.
So you spent 3 years there?
Yeah.
What were the duties you undertook in Kowloon?
In Kowloon, I was in a mobile signal section in the first place. This was what I was sent to Hong Kong for, to be an operator in the mobile signal section. And our job was to man vehicles with radios in and lay line work. In other words, a mobile signals infantry role for the defence of Kowloon.
What would your daily routine have been like?
In this infantry section, well, you had exercises, you had trade training, you'd go out to exercises for a week in the new territories, you had trade training. In that time, I changed over from an owl to a lineman. Lineman's basically used for, or is responsible for, line communication, laying lines and looking after the maintenance of lines and installing telephones and switchboard exchanges in fixed defence communications. And Hong Kong then had 3.7 AA gun areas. It had 6-inch coast defence and 9.2 coast defence. And having changed my trade to lineman, I was then employed. I left the signal section. The mobile signal section was then employed on the various fixed defence areas of Hong Kong.
Did you stay at Nathan Road when you changed to a lineman?
No, at that time, the Hong Kong Signal Company had instructions to move from Whitfield Barracks over to Victoria Barracks in Hong Kong. So we went across then in, I think, about 1940.
So when you were an owl, that was before you were a lineman, did you actually work at that in Hong Kong and in Kowloon? Or did
yes, with the mobile signal section, mm. Yes.
And when you were doing that job, what was your daily routine?
As an owl?
Yes.
To go out on exercises with the mobile signal, to work in close liaison with the Middlesex Regiment, the Kumanis, they were a Gurkha regiment that were in Hong Kong, and working close liaison with them, linking them up to brigade areas and so on.
And then when you became a lineman, your routine was what?
Then responsible for maintenance of coastal defence artillery installations. the switchboard exchanges, the mainframes, all the telephones and the routes of these telephones, either by internally within the batteries or batteries or faults, or from the Hong Kong British headquarters all the way along the various cable paths to forts and so on, miles and miles of underground cable that we had to maintain and indeed install. It was very much more interesting as far as I was concerned.
Did you have Chinese people working for you when you were doing that?
Yes, for the not within the forts, because they were out of bounds to the Chinese, but within laying main cables, 28 pair and so on, 28 pair 40, we had coolies who did the digging for us, and you'd go out to a site to lay the cable. You had four to six Chinese linemen, they're your own civilian staff linemen, and about 400 coolies would come up that day and so on, and you'd supervise the direction, the depth of cable laying and so on, and the jointing.
How were the coolies recruited?
Recruited through a comprador, a contractor, who generally, having been the lowest tender, then promptly put that out to various other contractors, so you had four or five contractors in line. It was handed all the way down, and the net result was that the poor coolie got hardly anything for his labour at all.
Where did they sleep and eat and so on?
I have no knowledge of that.
Why was the fortress out of bounds to Chinese civilian workers?
To casual civilian workers, yes. Why? Well, because there were fixed defence communications, the site, what was in them, and so on. And there was a lot of fifth column in Hong Kong before the war, especially from a fifth column that would later prove very effective for the Japanese. They knew everything, the location, the pinpoints, they knew the ranges to open up on fixed defence and so on. They knew exactly where, in fortresses, where the vital communication areas were.
Were you very aware of their activities as early as 1937 or 38?
Well, not the fifth column, no. I, as an ordinary soldier, would not be aware of fifth column activities, although in Fort Stanley, which was a 9.2, I was sent there for 9.2 gun sight, I was sent there for about 9 months. I found a Chinese well within the perimeter wire, because it had two sets of perimeter wires, well within the second one, and I apprehended him, took him to the guard room. Eventually I heard, and indeed I had to go and give evidence at a court, and he received, I think, somewhere about 3 years imprisonment.
What year?
Obviously, fifth column.
What year was that?
This was about early 41.
And what sort of court would have given him 3 years? Was it a civilian
court? Oh, civilian court, yes.
How soon did you begin to be aware of the build-up of Japanese strength?
My memory serves me right, and it's a long, long time ago now. The Japanese, I think, came on the Hong Kong border in about 1938. If you remember, they'd occupied Shanghai. They then took a coastal strip all the way down China, the vital places, for a depth of about 300 miles, thereby sealing China off from the sea. And they came to Hong Kong. The Chinese nationalists disappeared. All came into Hong Kong and surrendered their arms. And the Japanese then stayed in force on the Hong Kong border, the Kowloon border, and stayed that way until war was declared on the 8th of December 1941, until they declared war.
Was there much consciousness of the threat from Japan among you and your colleagues?
It was always there. Always there. That was the... Japan had one of the strongest navies of the world, and Hong Kong's defence originally, rather like Singapore, was the defence against seaborne invasion. It didn't happen that way. The Japanese struck across from their occupied territory in China.
Had you heard any anti-Japanese propaganda?
Anti-Japanese propaganda? From who?
I think you mentioned that you could buy atrocity films in
Hong
Kong.
Oh, yes, you could. In the normal Chinese shops, you could buy atrocity films of Chinese people executed, beheaded, waiting execution, hands tied behind their backs on their knees and so on. You could buy that sort of thing, yes.
Did a lot of people buy them?
To send home. A couple of people sent them home, yes.
And were you told anything about Japanese officially? Were you briefed on the nature of the Japanese threat?
The only thing we were told about the Japanese was the intelligence sources, shall I say, that they were short-sighted. They all had to wear glasses. They couldn't see at night. And various things which are entirely untrue. They couldn't fly by night, and so on. Why ever we were given intelligence like that, because it was absolute and utter rubbish.
Did the strain of the thought of the Japanese affect your day-to-day life? I mean, did you feel tense in a threatened situation? Or did life carry on much as normal?
Life carried on as normal. You were in a situation that you didn't know how, if you were attacked, how long it would last. The Hong Kong government had said it could hold out for 6 months. It had plenty of food and so on, water. Could hold for 6 months until reinforcements arrived. So we thought, well, 6 months, we'd be able to cope.
Did you mix much with the civilian population?
No, not at all. Not at all. Unless you're part of a YMCA group, you played with the squash with YMCA clubs and that sort of thing. I played football for Kowloon City and played against rather the well-known Chinese teams, North China, South China and so on. No, but the normal English Taipan, no.
How did you keep yourself entertained?
Well, you played sport all the time, or you went out in the evening to have a drink. But mainly it was sport. And the more sport you played, the more tired you felt, and the earlier you went to bed, ready for the next day's work.
Did you notice the activities of the Hong Kong Volunteer Defence Force at all?
They'd go on exercises with us, and one or two of our numbers would be detailed to go out for a weekend exercise with them, and we'd train them and give them some instruction and so on.
What did you think of their capacities?
Very good, yes, very good indeed. I mean, they're all highly intelligent people who were in business there, and they enjoyed it.
What nationalities were they?
Well, British, Portuguese, Russian, no Germans or Italians or anything like that. But some of the foreign nationals who were resident in Hong Kong would volunteer.
I think you said you did some social work in Hong Kong, or medical work, medical social work.
Yes, for the YMCA, one of my volunteer jobs was to, this was in the evening, to man an office in a Chinese area. And there I would don a white coat like a doctor, and I would see Chinese would come. These Chinese, they lived on the streets, they were refugees. They would come in, and one would diagnose, marking complete amateurs we were, we'd diagnose what was wrong with them, and if, obviously, we'd recommend or write a chit for them to go to see a doctor or to report to a hospital. But because it had come from the YMCA and for this organization, the hospitals would look at them and do the best they could for them. But we had no dispensary at all.
Why did they need to come through the YMCA?
The reason is that there was an organization with the YMCA. It was a voluntary organization, and I suppose that the YMCA, in their way, were helping the crisis of the refugees out by appearing to do something for them.
Did you do any other type of work for the YMCA, or voluntary work?
Any relief collection at all, flag days and things like that, yes. We were involved with the YMCA to quite some extent. And we mainly also from a sporting activity, squash and what have you, tennis and so on.
Was that connection officially encouraged, or was it a product of the initiative of soldiers themselves?
No, it was encouraged from the YMCA. There was no differentiation by the YMCA of nationality, creed, class, or anything like that. And there was a great bond between the YMCA in Hong Kong and the British soldier.
Did that involve you in any religious activity?
To some extent, but not very much.
When did the refugee situation begin to build up?
Built up when just before the when the Japanese invaded China, then the refugee situation became hectic.
So that was around 1940.
38.
As early as 38.
38. That's when the Japanese came along. You had Chinese nationalist soldiers that were trapped and couldn't get out, so they came in, gave up their arms. They were put in prisoner of war camps. And they stayed there.
Who put them in the prisoner of war camps?
British.
What army were they from?
They were the Chinese army, they were Chiang Kai-shek's army, and I wouldn't know which, whether it's a Kuangtung army or whatever they were from, but they were nationalist, Chinese nationalist soldiers.
Where was the prisoner of war camp that they were kept?
There were three that I remember in Hong Kong, but I was not involved in any guard duties on them at all.
And the other refugees weren't soldiers?
The refugees then were the usual flotsam and jetsam that flees before an invading army. People who've left their homes for fear of reprisals, or indeed just to maintain life, whole families, thousands of them on the march into Hong Kong.
And how did they arrive?
By foot, or sampan.
So by foot they would come through the new territory?
Yes.
And by sampan they would come up to Hong Kong Island?
Any part along the Kowloon coast or Hong Kong itself. But the influx was so great, it became a terrible problem.
Where were most of them accommodated?
Again, in camps. and then the refugee camps. And those that were cleared to given a period to stay were allowed to go out into the community and settle down.
What were your feelings when you heard that that war had broken out in Europe?
Very, very upset about that. Nothing I could do. I was already in uniform. We put in to a posting to Europe, and that wasn't granted, for obvious reasons that we were trained there, and they could not afford troop ships to replace soldiers in China. So we were destined to stay. My feelings, one of resignation, well, it's here, we've got to face it.
What were communications like with him?
Very good, as far as we were concerned, because we had actually built a radio that worked direct to UK, worked to Singapore and India and direct to UK. We'd built this radio. Some of the valves in it were 18 inches high and 2 foot high.
When did you hear about the Japanese Axis Alliance?
Well, that was in our papers and in our radio broadcasts. We had knowledge of this Three Axis Alliance. We'd also knowledge of the other alliance, and that was the ABCD Alliance, which was the American, British, China and Dutch Alliance.
Did you think it was a matter of time before there was some kind of attack on Hong Kong?
It was inevitable as far as I was concerned, yes.
And how did you see Hong Kong holding out?
As I said earlier, I could see it only holding out for about 6 months at the most.
What did you think would happen to you after it had fallen?
Well, would become a prisoner of war if you were lucky to get that far, to be taken if you weren't killed off before then.
So if you thought about it, you did foresee the possibility that you would become a prisoner of war?
Exactly, yes.
Were you given any kind of briefing or instructions on how to cope with being made a prisoner of war?
None at all, no.
Were you filled with fear at the thought of being a prisoner of war of the Japanese, since they hadn't signed the Geneva Convention?
I wasn't to know at the time they hadn't signed the Geneva Convention. You're a soldier.